Welcome to the ACRL Files. Our listeners know that the American College of Real Estate Lawyers is a national organization of 1,000 distinguished practitioners fostering the exchange of the most sophisticated ideas and experiences in the development, financing, and investment in real estate. We continue our series of podcasts with leading individuals in commercial real estate who have built the companies that have shaped the industry to share reflections on their careers and predictions for the future. Today, I am pleased to welcome a next generation leader, Sarah Hawkins, CEO of the East Region for Hines, including New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and DC. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jay. Honored to be here.
Thank you. So before we talk about your incredible career at Blackstone and Fortress and Hines, I thought we should sort of roll back and start at the beginning a little bit. So tell us about, you know, where you grew up, what influenced you to focus on real estate, and ultimately how you found your way to Hines.
So I am a Texas native, grew up in Houston, Texas, which is actually the home base of Hines, where Hines was founded, though I'd say it's more coincidental that I found my way to Hines. I've only worked in New York for Hines, but grew up in Texas, went to University of Texas, give you a hook'em for those looking at the video. And, you know, I think the best way to describe it is that I have always been a super competitive person, for good or bad. That has just been how I was born, uber competitive across all things. And I was in the business school at UT, and at the time, the kind of most in-demand jobs were doing investment banking. Wanted to go to New York. That was kind of what I wanted to do, and kind of the jobs that were most competitive at the time. And I was able to get a role as an intern at Blackstone. And I went as a summer intern, really my first time spending any time in New York, and I just loved it. Loved the energy of it, loved the, I was around such smart people, and I just had a phenomenal experience. But I was not in the real estate group. I was in the restructuring group. But I went as a summer intern in 2006, came back as a full-time analyst in 2007, 8, and 9. And it was not a good time for general deal-making, as we all know, but it was an excellent time as an analyst in the restructuring group. I mean, it was an incredible learning experience for me, witnessing what was going on in the world and having and being part of, at the time, the restructuring group at Blackstone, we had a seat at the table at Bear Stearns when the two hedge funds failed originally. My first assignment was working on municipal bond insurers that were kind of the first to go, and they got in, they moved from the municipal bond insurance to CMBS and CDO and CLO and all that started to fall. So I had this incredible seat at the table, really watching what was happening. And the amount I learned was so valuable, particularly financial analysis. You know, I just got an incredible course in financial analysis. And that really benefited me kind of moving forward. And I went to Fortress after that for a relatively short stint. And that's where I got exposure to real estate. And so I did not grow up in a real estate family. My dad was actually is a litigator. He says he'll never retire. And so that's where I got exposure to real estate. And I really loved the ability to combine my ability to do financial analysis with the physical real estate. And I just found it fascinating and so exciting in New York City. So coming out of Fortress, I knew I wanted to stay within real estate. And someone told me to get coffee with someone from Hines. They said it's a great organization. And I grabbed coffee with someone. They had me meet other people. And I was completely blown away by how much everyone I met loved their job. I had never seen anything like that. The passion they talked about with what they were working on and how excited they were about what's going on. And I just wanted to be part of it. And the The person running the office at the time, Tommy Craig in New York, said, we need someone that knows financial analysis and can run all the numbers for us. We'll teach you everything you need to know about construction and design, and we'll teach it to you. We just need you to be able to run the Excel models. So I said, okay.
Okay, so it's a great story, right? Because as you say, your beginnings at Blackstone and a little bit at Fortress weren't, at least at Blackstone, were not real estate based. So you came
Correct.
to the table, and I know your first project was that beautiful building at Seven Bryant Park that they were developing. But tell us before you sort of talk about the real estate, how did all of that wonderful background during the GFC and watching all the financial pieces of the matrix fall apart and get put back together. How did that help you? How did that influence you on what you then turned to when you joined Hines?
So the amount that I learned in such a short period of time, and it was a 2 year analyst stint, and so and I tell other people that do this, it's 2 years, and you can work a lot. And I know I had no other responsibilities. I was doing the typical investment banking hours, and the amount that I just processed and learned. But I would also say doing that in a true culture of excellence, where the expectations were really high, the standards were really high, and you had to step up to the plate and perform. I remember, so when I was an intern, when I was an intern, it was still small enough at Blackstone that Steve Schwarzman came, and we sat in a conference room, and it was just a small group of us, and he came and talked to all of us, and it was kind of funny. He like. As a side story, he was doing a deal at the time, as he told us, and he picked, there was a physical phone in the office, and he picked up and said, yes, we're going to buy it. And it was, I think, gold bond socks or something like that. I still wonder if that was all kind of made up, that he real whether that he really was taking that call and doing it, but it was just such a, it was such a show. It was great. But what he told us, what I was wanted to tell you, is what he told us in that and when we were in that conference room, is when you were in college, you could score a 90 and that would be an A. That does not cut it at Blackstone. We expect 100% all the time. 90 doesn't work. And that
That's
just stuck
great.
with me, you know?
Yeah.
And like, there's a little bit of this fear of failure. But it also motivated you because you knew that what you put in front of anyone, as the analyst, what I put in front of the associate needed to be perfect. And if I made a mistake once, that was okay, but I better not make that mistake again.
Right. Well, it's yeah, that's a great lesson. And as you say, you really worked at and are working at two of the most excellent and high standard places in the world, Blackstone and Hines. I met Laura when she was like you at River Point in Chicago when we were looking to move there. So, and that's how the organization works, right? Laura worked her way to the top, right? She didn't simply get
Yeah.
appointed to become successor to Jeff. So it is a
That's
terrific
right.
organization, right? And so then you start, you're working on this huge project in New York, right? On a very iconic location, great design. And now you got to learn about real estate. So
Yeah.
how does that go?
So some advice that I got, because I started as an assistant project manager on the development, and someone told me there are a million things. A million tasks that have to happen on development. And there's a lot of things the senior people just don't even want to deal with. So the way you can make yourself indispensable is take on the things they don't want to deal with and go make it happen. Go run with it. So I thought about how, what are the things that I can do? Because I liked feeling like I could own something and then go accomplish it and solve the problem, right? It's a lot of problem solving. And so I'd say that was one thing, is making yourself indispensable. I ran all the financial models, so that was one. Like, that was kind of my what hired me. And so that was being part of all the financing discussions and making sure that was done in a way that was excellent and comprehensive. But then I also did things, which is, this is where it became very different than the job I had been doing before. Now, we had to get a new stand operator off of the site. And so I took that on. No one wants to deal with the maddening experience of having to remove a newsstand operator from your site. I mean, it is so archaic, the whole process with the different government agencies that you have to do. You know, there's like one attorney that has a monopoly on this whole business in New York City. I mean, it's just all these New York, just great anecdotes that come with it. But I took that on, and I, you know, will never forget Mr. Bipin Patel, who I was negotiating with, and he was a hard negotiator, but we came to terms. I got him off the site. We did not delay the construction, and I made that annoyance, that problem, go away in a way that worked out for everyone.
Okay, so you then obviously get very deep into that project. You develop a fabulous building in New York City. Tell us then how you move from your first real estate project to, move up in Hines and ultimately become a manager and a very significant leader for, I think you guys have, 30 plus million square feet in this East region and $20 billion of assets. So how did you get to there from just being a little lowly assistant project manager?
Well, I would like to say it's just, you know, hard work and intellect, but clearly, and as you look back on your career, there's a component of luck always, and you want to take advantage when the kind of luck shines its light on you and gives you an opportunity, take advantage of that. But on that project that I was working on, the person who hired me, so the senior person on actually on the project ended up leaving Hines a few months after I joined. Then the person right above me, you know, I was the assistant project manager, the project manager ended up leaving. I was basically all that was left. So it was up to me to step up and either own it and show that I could do it, or miss the opportunity. And so some of that was just luck of there, you know, looking around, there's no one else. But I also wanted it. I wanted, you know, I was ambitious and competitive, as I said in the beginning, and I felt like I can do this. It was a little bit outside of my comfort zone every time I had to take that step up. But I wanted to own. So in this instance at Seven Bryant Park, you know, I was always working under Tommy Craig, who was our head of the New York office and really the kind of top lead of the project. But I wanted to own as much as I could of it and be a leader. So yeah,
Okay.
I guess that's it, Jay. It's it. Both working hard, doing a good job, but also taking advantage of opportunities when they present themselves.
Okay. And as I tell my kids all the time, the harder you work, luck is important, but the harder you work, the luckier you get. Right.
Yeah,
So
that's
you
right.
right, you put yourself out there and
Yeah.
you got some good, I'm sure quite well-deserved breaks. So how did you learn? Project management is one obviously very important aspect of being successful in this business. What about how did you learn? And you come to the table, of course, with a terrific finance background and financial understanding of that. How did you learn the ins and outs? Who were your mentors on sort of deal strategy and what was next after Seven Bryant Park?
So the mentor, the wonderful thing about working on a live project is I could learn from the senior people on the team, and I took advantage of that. So I spent a ton of time with Tommy Craig, who's one of the best in the businesses, learning side by side with him, walking the site with him, reviewing the plans with him, talking through negotiating tactics with him, sitting in the room with him as he was leading the process, whether it's with the general contractor or with our partner. With the landowner, et cetera. But I also took advantage of spending time with our, you know, we have amazing construction managers, operations managers, and spending time with them to learn how to know, because what I knew was the financial side. I did not know the physical real estate at all. And that was really the big gap for me. And I had to learn the physical real estate. And the best way to learn that is just on the job, right? Walking the site with the experts. And I was fortunate to have really wonderful people who enjoyed mentoring and teaching. But I asked a lot of questions.
Right. It's funny you mentioned that. I mean, it's sort of obvious in your side of the business that yes, walking the site, we tell lawyers, right? When you're working on these projects, unless it's far away, if it's in your town or region, go see the project. Understand what's really going on, what are the easements, what's happening, and you'll be a much better, counselor, to the clients that you're working with. So
Makes a big difference. And we are big believers with our whole consulting team, including the lawyer, our lawyers, who we value tremendously. The more that we can bring them in and make project or the acquisition or the transaction, whatever is alive for them, so they understand all the nuances, the better.
You've got, now lots and lots of experience. You're way too young to look back on your career yet, but let's just, a new deal comes in, right? A new, let's just a new let's make it simple for now, because I want to talk a little bit more about this, but let's say a new office building opportunity comes into you, whether development or not. What are the key sort of points of analysis for you, and how do you get through that with your team to decide whether that's a deal worth pursuing?
Okay. Yeah, I mean that there's a lot of kind of dynamics, but an office itself right now, there's a very high bar, as you can imagine, for an office building. You started with it being an office building. But we're believers in office building, so I'll just take that one. So there, some of this is fairly simple. Location matters almost more than anything, almost more than the quality of the building, the location matters. And that's even more so post-COVID. So we need to be believers in the location. Then we need to be believers in the quality of the building. And because if you think about long term, we want to own well-located, high-quality assets. And that is the basic boundaries that we're going to operate within. Then it's the financial, there's all kinds of financial analysis. Are we getting it at a good price? Do we leave? Is it all about getting? Is it all about pricing, or is it also about where we can take this asset and what we can do? And ultimately, depending on whether it's a development, redevelopment, or just a pure core acquisition, it's what edge does Hines have? What is it about what we can bring to the table that we could pay a higher price than someone else? And it may be in some markets, it's where we believe in rent growth where others don't.
And today, I mean, as you say, it's a very tough time or challenging time, right, to look at these assets, office assets. How do you underwrite, what's your view? How do you underwrite office today, when as we continue to, deal with remote work, hybrid work, and all the things that, you and I've talked about, and they're in the news still all the time?
Okay, well, the challenge with office right now is there are so few transactions that no one really knows what an office exit cap rate is. But we can underwrite to a yield that makes sense based on where debt rates are. And that doesn't mean there's going to be investor capital for it, though. But as a real estate developer and owner and investor, we are not making any investments by ourselves. So we work with partners on almost everything that we do, even if it's within our fund business, right? It's partners that make up those funds. And so we are, it's on us to make recommendations on where good opportunities are, but it needs to make sense for our investors as well. And so most of our investors today are not interested in equity investments in office. Now, I think that's going to change over the next few years. And we see a pretty compelling opportunity within office, particularly in the credit space right now. There's just incredible dislocation in credit for office buildings in particular. But I am very convinced that we will be doing more office development in our future. You just take New York City, and there is more demand than there is supply today for the highest quality office buildings.
Just to follow, so on the credit issue, does that mean that, a company like Hines could be actually issuing, debt or pref equity or something in the office market instead of taking development risk?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Okay, anybody who knows Hines knows that every Hines office building is the top of the market. And you heard Owen Thomas at the roundtable meeting in January talk about the differences in positive absorption in the top 10% versus negative absorption in the bottom 90%. Your group is obviously in the top 10%. We're lucky to be tenants in Chicago and Houston and probably other places I can't remember at the minute. So I'm very familiar with Heinz quality. And presumably that's what continues to differentiate you from the competition. There's a few other people in that group, but you know, developing the best of the best gets you tenants when people come back to work.
Yes, agreed. Can
Okay,
we expand on
so
that? Yeah, I mean, yes, I mean that is the value that we think we bring. We know office incredibly well. I mean, we're spending a ton of time thinking about what the future of the workplace and what off the future of office. I mean, there will be a future for office, right? There is a large percentage of office buildings that needs to go away. Like if you look at office as a whole, we are over-officed in the US. So there is a high percentage of office buildings, you know, let's say 20 to 30% that need to go away. But the higher quality office buildings, and that's I'm talking nationally, right? But the higher quality buildings, and not just the very top 10%, because there's going to be enough demand that it's gonna fall below that as well. But that especially for that top 10%, which is what, you know, typically we're developing, there is even today more demand than there is supply. And supply is falling off a cliff. There's no new developments for office happening.
right. So we're going to be back in that period. This is a cyclical business, as all of our listeners know, and you know, we're going to be back in that period, right, where we're supply constrained. So if you're looking in this flight to quality, I think this is what Owen was saying that day, and you want to get into one of these top 10% buildings, you may be surprised to see that rents are not full of all the concessions that you're reading about in the B and C buildings.
Yeah, there's never been better pricing power and more a bigger differential between the net effect of rents between those highest quality buildings and everything else.
Interesting. Oh, that's good to hear for the good to hear for our owner clients, no less so maybe for tenants, but I'm sure they'll figure it out too. So everybody, as we've been saying, knows that Hines is one of the premier office developers, both nationally and internationally. But you, I know, were involved very much in some of the expansion of the company into other asset classes. So talk a little bit about what Hines is not as well known for, but in fact is very active in.
Great. Well, yes, thank you for that because most people do still associate us as an office developer. But we have a very large scale residential business, industrial build business, mixed use build business. We are global and we have an active investment management platform. So we are investing discretionary funds on behalf of LPs and investors. As well as continuing to do one-off development deals, some with our funds, some directly with one-off investors. But a big push for us over the last decade has been into the residential space and into the industrial space. So just in the East, we had no industrial 10 years ago. Today, we have control of sites and existing assets that get us to close to 4 million square feet of industrial space. So we are a large scale player in this kind of nationally in the industrial space. And one of the products that we're most bullish about looking forward right now is residential. I'd say, you know, I sit here in New York, so particularly in the East Coast, we have not seen the run up of supply. We are in highly undersupplied with high barriers to entry markets. And we don't have the large supply buildup that you've seen in the Southeast and Southwest and the Sun Belt markets. So where some of those non-gateway markets, you have 7 years of supply. In the gateway markets in the US, you have 2 years of supply, which is basically at equilibrium, at parity. So you will be able, this is what we were talking about making kind of investment decisions. We believe in rent growth for multifamily in the East Coast markets. Like we will be able to push rents there where you haven't been able to. It's been, you know, rents are going down in many of the non-gateway markets because of the supply.
And you
So
think that rent growth opportunity, because you of course read about that even the multifamily sector is pressured because of increasing interest rates and construction costs.
yeah, so when you are buying assets that result in negative leverage because we're still transacting below where debt rates are, right, in multifamily, the math doesn't work unless you believe in rent growth. And when over the last few years, if you're fearing a pending recession, it's hard to get any investor to, or ourselves or RIC, to justify rent growth. So you have to know the locations incredibly well, know the supply demand dynamics, and be able to believe in rent growth to justify making that, taking on negative leverage if you're going to.
And what do you think the opportunity, if that's the right word, if it's an opportunity, you said before, you use the great phrase that we used to use a lot of times when the shopping center industry, that the U.S. is not over retailed, it's just under demolished. Right. So that maybe that's where we are with some of this, particularly the older office building stock in places like Manhattan and others. So what do you
Well,
think
I should
the
just say, I
opportunity?
well, what I hope is that we can do a lot more conversions, though
Well,
right
that's what I was
now
going to ask you.
it's,
Yeah.
oh, okay.
That's what I was just going to say.
Because you're
What do
saying,
you
okay,
think the
that's,
opportunity is? We're not going to demolish all these office buildings. You and I have heard about some very interesting ways of using buildings. But what about, as we're talking about multifamily, the office to residential conversion opportunity?
yeah, we are not today in an environment where that makes a lot of sense in most markets. And that's both because the pricing isn't there. So pricing hasn't dropped enough, or transaction owners haven't capitulated enough on pricing for that to make sense. And if you just take Manhattan, the land basis has to be significantly lower than where most office owners are holding their assets today. And the cost of construction and the zoning requirements right now make it incredibly challenged without some sort of government intervention or subsidy. And so I'm hopeful that the state government will come to an agreement to make it more feasible for multifamily in general, 421A replacement. But there are other incentives that would be helpful in spurring that along, because today the cost to construct, and the other thing you have to remember is you it's it most of these buildings are not empty. So when you don't have an empty building, you're dealing with tenancy issues. So where we have found that we spend a lot of time on this, where we have found it kind of where it could potentially work and where we're spending time is pre-war buildings in Midtown South, for example, where the existing building lays out fairly rationally for residential. And I think you will see in conversions in those sort of buildings. There are some underway in the financial district, and I'm rooting for those and hope they're successful. And I'd like to see a lot more of it. It's the most obvious disconnect when you have the mayor saying, when you have 600,000 units of housing that we need, and we have over 100 million square feet of vacant or underutilized space in the office market. It's just, I would love to see more of that match happen. And we'd love to be part of it. It's like, we're a vertically integrated developer and would love to come in and make that happen and be part of it. But it financially today does not make much sense.
Yeah, so you, I mean, as you're saying, you need public-private cooperation, be it tax incentives or other things. And as you say it, right, everybody has been talking about how difficult this is and challenging from construction and depth of floors. But in fact, right, the New York City Financial District, which was almost all office pre-2001, has, as you know, a tremendous amount of, live, work, and play space where buildings were converted as they came back online after 9/11.
Yes. So it's
So
possible.
it's
Yeah.
possible, right? So
Yes.
let's keep our fingers crossed. Tell us a little bit about not just your general multifamily. You talked about the industrial. What about your senior housing piece?
Well, we have two senior housing projects that are complete in Manhattan today, one at 56th and Lex and one at 85th and Broadway. And we have, they're beautiful buildings, and ones that I was really part of leading kind of from the very beginning. And the way that came about was the CEO of Welltower, the healthcare REIT at the time, Tom DeRosa, he identified, he looked at Manhattan and said, I want to own senior housing in Manhattan, and there's nothing to buy because there is almost no senior housing that existed in Manhattan. And so I can't buy it, so I want to build it, and I want to work with one of the best developers to do it. And so let's partner up and make it happen. And so we quickly came together on that and kind of went in with the thesis of we wanted to build senior housing that felt like a residence, did not feel institutional, something that you would be proud for your spouse or your parent to live in. It feel like a home and a residence and a comfortable transition and not like a hospital, and be heavy on the care model to have care that's dependable, that you can trust. And we've had a wonderful partner in Sunrise Senior Living on both assets, and they do care better than anyone. It's amazing today, and so just satisfying for me personally to walk in to our project at 56th Street and experience the love and care that the residents there get every day. So it's a something we're really proud of. We have an aging population, so the demographic, like we are in the demographic moment where there's a dramatic need for better care for seniors. And we've done these two in Manhattan. We're actively looking at opportunities in other cities and in the suburbs in particular.
And as you say, it sounds like the key to doing that, not knowing what the company's history was and strengths, right, was finding the right partners to bring the expertise to the overall transaction.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, caring for seniors when at our two projects with a high acuity, so a lot of needs, with many with dementia or Alzheimer's. It is a care model, and that is not what we do. So we wanted to partner with the best real estate owner in senior housing because this was our first senior housing project. So that was Welltower, and then the best operator, and that was, we interviewed and talked to a lot of operators, and we selected Sunrise, and they've just been a wonderful partner. And we opened 56th Street in the middle of COVID. So opening a senior housing residence in the middle of a, global pandemic that disproportionately impacts the elderly in a congregate setting was an incredible challenge that could have tested any partnership. And they were wonderful through it all. And the staff is wonderful, and it's a great, great place. We've been really happy with those projects.
Well,
Really
I
proud
mean,
of
when you right, I mean, when you think about that, not only was it COVID, but everybody was leaving Manhattan. N
them.
nobody
Oh,
was
completely.
coming, but,
Yes.
right? Right. That's amazing. So let me just change topics and ask you a different question. You've worked with, as I said, our initial audience is American College of Real Estate Lawyers. You've worked with lots of good lawyers. I know lots of those folks that represent Hines. You've also worked with lots of great real estate brokers and advisors. Tell us what you think are the attributes that make those people really good and make the best ones better than the rest.
So I started kind of talking about my experience at Blackstone and then at Hines with the standard of excellence and being great at your job. I have to just start with that, right? The people that we work the best with are the excellent lawyers that know the documents inside and out, know the questions that we should be asking, understand. I mean, we have worked with incredible tax lawyers that the complexity of some of these deals, it just boggles your mind, and the value that they can bring to us to help us navigate, is, they make themselves indispensable. So starting with, but our kind of traditional real estate attorneys, the ones that we have worked with and continue to work with, because we tend to be pretty loyal. When you do a good job for us, we want to continue to give you business. And when you know us and learn about us and then can know how to work well within our organization, we want to continue to give you business. But they have just been amazingly excellent at knowing the documents, knowing what they're doing. So I just have to start with that, being great lawyers. That's like first and foremost, clearly the most important. But then I'd say second, understanding the nuances of our particular organization. So understanding Hines, how we operate, what we care about, what are the important terms to us, and also understanding how you get a deal done with the different personalities that are within our organization. So the people that have worked with us for decades know how I operate. They know how Tommy, who was our prior kind of head of New York, operated, Jason, who's now running New York for us, for example. And so they really know the organization and know us.
Okay, great. So I know you're involved in the roundtable. I think you're involved in ULI. Tell us what role those kinds of organizations have played for you and why they're important.
Well, this is probably not the answer you expected, but I'm relatively new to both of those organizations. And it was a very intentional decision because in general, I am I try to be very discerning with my time because my job is very demanding. I travel a lot. I'm sure like you, could work all hours of the day if I really let myself do that. I also have three kids. So I have three boys, ages 10, 8, and 5. And I'm married, and spending time with my husband and my kids is a huge priority for me. So I want to be incredibly discerning when I spend time on elective things outside of that. So I decided this year, and I'd say it's a bit of an experiment, to lean in on two organizations, ULI, that are real estate related, because I am involved in a few things outside of that, but to ULI and the Real Estate Roundtable. And ULI, it has been, I joined a council, and it has been a wonderful experience of getting to know peers in the industry and sharing stories and knowledge and friendship. It's been surprisingly fun for me to do that in a really positive way that I think has been really good for me. So that's that. And then the Real Estate Roundtable, I just joined at the beginning of this year. And I cover our DC market, so I spend a lot of time in DC. And a number of our investors, clients are also involved. And so it's an opportunity for me to see them. And for Hines generally, for us to kind of understand the pulse of what's going on nationally for real estate. So that was the reason for those two.
Well, look, that's a great, honest answer. And we see that all the time in organizations where we're trying to recruit young professionals like you and who are balancing those very important things outside of work and really demanding jobs. So doesn't surprise me. I'm glad that you picked those two because I too think they're terrific organizations, right? And the good news for you is that the spring meeting for ULI is in your backyard. So no travel in April for that.
Exactly.
So good. So this has been a great conversation and I really appreciate your time in doing this. Let me just close with a few questions. You've told us what Schwartzman's very good advice about commitment to excellence. My question was going to be, what's the best deal advice you've ever gotten beyond that comment?
So when I joined Hines, when I was looking for an organization that not only excited me just from a work perspective, but also where I felt like my values were aligned with the organization. And Hines is known, and I spent a lot of time asking around about the reputation for Hines, but known for acting with integrity in all that we do. And it's something we talk about a lot. treating people the right way, treating partners the right way. And I hope those listening, that that's how you view Heinz, because it's really important to us, treating people the right way. And so that is the most important thing going into a deal or a transaction, is that we are acting with transparency, openness, integrity. And because many times the deals that we're doing, they're complicated. We're working with, if it's a development site, we're convincing a landowner. And a lot, many times, especially in the East Coast markets, you're dealing with landowners who have owned a site for decades, if not generations. And so building trust and building trust to ultimately be able to get to a deal that works for both parties.
Okay.
And that is how we approach negotiation. And I think first and foremost, that is kind of that's number one, is doing it the right way. And that then leads to more deals for us, because people want to work with us. They value our partnership. They know that we're going to say that we're going to do what we say we're going to do. You know, we hear that time and time again, even in, you know, not just development sites, but when we're acquiring, when we want to put in a bid to acquire an asset, there's tremendous credibility because the seller knows that we will perform, right? If we're going to commit to a deal, we're going to perform. So that integrity is really the most important thing when approaching a deal.
Okay, great. So my last question is, if investor comes to you tomorrow saying, I've got $100 million to invest in real estate, what would your advice be?
I am going to say right now that my highest conviction idea is residential in the East Coast. So I think for the long term, for an individual, they can put $100 million in. The growth potential, the ability, you know, it is kind of in an inflationary environment, a really attractive investment. And we are dramatically undersupplied. And so there's real growth potential. I really believe the opportunity within residential is pretty exciting on the East Coast right now.
Great. Well, I love the optimism. And
You know,
I'm
I'm
hoping it's
tempted to
right.
say office, but I bit my tongue, but I have a few office opportunities in mind, but we're going to give it a little time to let the market settle. But office is going to be where investors are going to make the most money. Maybe not the most risk adjusted in this moment, but investors will make the most mo money in office over the next 10 years.
Okay,
That's my
great.
prediction.
Great. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. I am sure our listeners will take a lot away from your insights. And I hope that your predictions are right and that we see the markets coming back, if not obviously tomorrow, but in the not too distant future, so we can all be doing interesting transactions and celebrating wins for everybody.
Really fun talking to you, Jay. Thanks for having me.